Professor of English, I am sure the chairman was tempted to translate a theory of the consumption function into a theory of the phthisis function. Is that the way you pronounce that word? This is a truly interdisciplinary gathering, as evidence of which I, who am a mere working economist, am listed as talking to you on the program about philosophy, about which I know nothing. But I hasten to add that if you look on the program, you will see that not only is liberalism in quotes, but so also is the real problem of the conservative theory, and so also is a new stage in conservative thought, so we're all in quotes. Because I would do want to speak as a liberal, and from the point of view of the philosophy, which I understand to be the true philosophy of liberalism, because some other people have come along and misappropriated an ancient and honorable word and have taken it to mean the opposite of what it always and historically has meant, is no reason why those of us who believe in that philosophy, in that view, should let the theft go without comment and accede to it. In our arrangements for this symposium tonight is that each of the three of us is going to try to keep his comments down to 15 or 20 minutes so that there will be ample time for discussion both among us and among the rest of the fellowship gathered here. I have tried in deciding what to say in those few minutes to choose a few points to emphasize which seem to me to relevant to the purpose of our discourse, which is to see wherein we really do have differences of view about the philosophy which in large measure we all have in common, and to what extent these differences arise merely from the mode of expression or the particular features which each one of us emphasizes. Speaking as a liberal, by which I mean a person who believes in individual freedom as a central problem in social organization, I thought I might start by commenting briefly on what I think in many ways is a fundamental problem of our philosophy, which is what is the source of our belief in freedom? Why do we give such primacy to freedom? Why do we believe in freedom? Let me say that I'm going to abbreviate very much, and this is, I think, perfectly all right in this gathering, because everybody here has really thought all about all of these issues. And if I say a few words, that'll bring to all of your minds ideas which you have thought about before, and it would be impossible for me to cover in full the points I am going to make in any other way except by reminding you of things you already know if I'm going to keep it down to 15 or 20 minutes. Well, as I see it, our belief in freedom rests fundamentally on two pillars. One is the belief in individualism and the individual as the ultimate entity in the world and society. And the second, and that one I am going to pass by and really hardly discuss at all, but the second, which I think is very much more relevant to our dialogue or discourse trialogue here tonight, is humility. And I think you can bring out the role of humility by asking yourself the rhetorical question, can anybody believe that another man should be free to sin? Do you believe in freedom to sin? On one level, one of the common answers to this, about which again there will be no dispute, so I will pass it by, is that obviously you've got to be in favor of letting men be free to sin, because there is no merit in people's not sinning unless they are free to sin. So that in a way you say you've got to let men be free to sin, provided they don't, because that's the only way in which there's merit in their not sinning. And it's that provided they don't that leads you to the second base, and I think more basic reason, why you have to say you must let men be free to sin. If you really knew what sinning was, of course you couldn't. But are you sure you really know? This is why it's a question of humility. Fundamentally, I think, if you were absolutely confident, perfectly certain, had no doubts about what was sinning and what was not, then I think you will be driven to say, I cannot let men be free to sin. And if those of us, like myself, who would say, oh, of course we must let men be free to sin, we say so because we say, after all, there's a little margin of our doubt in our minds. Maybe we're wrong. Who am I to say and to insist to the other man that what he is doing is a sin? I am always reminded in this context of that wonderful quotation from one of the least humble men in history, Oliver Cromwell, who said on one occasion this wonderful comment to those whom he was insisting should be of like mind with him, and he said to them, "By the bowels of Christ, I beseech you, bethink you, you may be mistaken." Well, that's really the point. It's because we must bethink us that we may be mistaken, and we must always say, if another man differs fundamentally from us, if I think what he's doing is sinning and he thinks it's not, well then, maybe I'm wrong, maybe he's right. Of course, I don't really believe he's wrong. I really believe I'm right. But nonetheless, the basic reason I believe for our belief in individual freedom, for our belief that we must have unanimity among people and avoid coercion, that I must not force another man to follow my dictates, the basic reason is that there's always that little bit of doubt in our mind, maybe we're wrong. Humility. Now, I think it is very important to distinguish two misleading interpretations that can be between two different kind of interpretations that can be placed on this. One tendency is to go quickly from this notion of humility to a different notion, which is to say there are no such things as absolute standards of value, all ethics are relative. That's not the same view at all. That's a wholly different view. That's a view that there is no such thing as sinning. The proposition, there are absolute moral standards, absolute values, but I'm not quite sure what they are, is a wholly different proposition from the proposition there are no absolute standards. So when I emphasize humility as a basis for freedom, I am not in any way at all meaning to give aid and comfort to the notion that there are no such things as absolute standards, or at least I believe there are absolute standards. I think another contrast which needs to be pointed out and in some ways extremely relevant to our discussion tonight is that humility is not the same thing as pleading ignorance. I may say, of course, I may have a margin of doubt. It's possible I can be wrong. That doesn't lead me from feeling very strongly that I am right and urging very strongly on you the view. More particularly, one of the arguments, and the reason I cite this is relevant to our discourse tonight, one of the arguments that is sometimes made by the traditionalists, as they are called, or the people who emphasize the great virtue of tradition, is that we are ignorant about what the consequences of changes are. We cannot predict what will happen. We know that what exists works, and therefore you ought to be very hesitant of tinkering with it because you might get something worse. Well, of course, there's a good deal of merit in that general position. Of course, it is true that things often happen very differently from the way you expect them to. And of course, there's a great argument in favor of making changes in such a way that you can try them out on a small scale if possible. But I think it is not a valid inference from that view, not a valid exercise of the relevant humility, to carry this all the way. And those of us who are liberals in the traditional sense, I think, do not do so. There are many things we know. We know very, very well what the consequences of price support in agriculture are. And we propose, if we can, to get rid of them and to change things. We don't want to keep them there just because they happen to develop. And this is a general problem in science as opposed to values. In science, we must always keep in mind the possibility that we're never absolutely certain, that there is a margin of doubt, but yet there are some things we know a lot better than other things. And there are some things we have a good deal of confidence in. So that my emphasis on humility is not an argument that we are ignorant or that we cannot predict the consequences of change, but only an argument that we must keep in mind the possibility that we may be mistaken, and hence we ought to be very, very careful in trying to impose our views on somebody who is of a different mind. Now, the essence of a freedom in a free society is that you do not coerce others. And yet the essence of a complicated mass society of the kind we deal with is that millions of men must cooperate with one another. And as you all know, all of us recognize that the major device that we have for reconciling this kind of cooperation with individual freedom is a free market in one or another of its forms. And the second main point I wanted to touch on briefly tonight is to call attention to the fact that the free market as a device for reconciling cooperation with freedom is far broader in scope than we ordinarily think of. There is a strong tendency to think that there is somehow an economic sphere of life in which the free market is an appropriate means of organizing activity and getting people to cooperate together with one another. And there is another sphere of life where some other technique has to be adopted. And all I want to emphasize is that what we mean by the free market is simply a system of voluntary cooperation which applies in a very broad area. In particular, it has always seemed to me impressive that the academic community, which is so much opposed often to the use of the free market in economic affairs, is so much in favor of it in the area in which it itself operates, namely in the field of thought and speech and ideas. Because, truth to tell, the principle of progress in science and in literature and art, which arises out of letting individuals decide freely what they shall do with their own resources, what kind of pictures they shall paint, what kind of books they shall write, what kind of research they shall do, allowing for free competition in the world of ideas in the hope that the better idea will down the poorer idea, allowing the consumer to be free to choose what ideas he wants to accept, is essentially the free market principle of reconciling diversity with cooperation, of avoiding conformity. In fact, I have often been impressed by the interesting comparison of the two groups of people who seem to me, in general, the greatest enemy of a free society. On the one hand, there are the businessmen. They are the great enemies of free society because almost every businessman is in favor of free enterprise for everybody else, but against it for himself. On the other hand, the intellectuals, strange to say, are often against the free enterprise society because they're in favor of it for themselves and against it for everybody else. Just the other way around. So the second main point I wanted to emphasize was the importance in thinking of a free society of recognizing the wide scope for free market arrangements for reconciling cooperation with freedom. Now, the third thing I wanted to say is that there is, in order for a society, in order for a free society to exist, it is unquestionably true that there must exist a basic set of common values which are accepted unthinkingly on the basis of which people operate and which are not in dispute. Unless there is a large common base, a society will be torn apart. If men really differ about basic things in which they believe very, very strongly, they are going to be led to settle them by bullets and not by ballots. And civil wars throughout history have demonstrated this. And this is a common core of agreement with the traditionalist, with the traditional conservative, and the liberal, all really agree that a free society must have a body of values which is commonly accepted and provides this cohesive base. This is, of course, the role of tradition. It is the role of religion. It is a valid element in those that emphasize these things. But I want to make two points about it. From the point of view of the liberal who approaches the problem. The first is that while a society needs a common set of values, it isn't true that any set will do. There are common sets of values which people can hold, which will provide for order, but not for freedom. And indeed, this is one of the areas where I think we know least about the requisites of a free society. What are the ranges? What are the kinds of common values which have the property that they can serve as the basis for a free society? And the second point I want to make, which ties this one up with what I have just been saying, is that just as a free market, voluntary cooperation, is a means of organizing economic activity, just as it is a means of organizing thought, research, discussion, so also it is a means for building up these basic sets of values. We must not suppose that such basic sets of values necessarily come from outside or are revealed by religion or are imposed by somebody. They too can be the product of a free society and of the search by individuals in trying to organize their ideas and live with one another. The most obvious example is human language. A common language, speaking of English in the same way, or of French or whatever it may be, has frequently been observed to be an essential element in order and disorder. You need only look at what is happening in India and the extent to which it is being torn apart by linguistic states to see that this is a very important element of that common culture which holds the people together. Yet, that language was never revealed, was never constructed deliberately. It was a free market development. It was produced in the same way in which our system of interconnected markets, producing agriculture, retail stores was produced, by people cooperating with one another, and gradually a language grew. And in the same way, those commonly accepted values, beliefs, attitudes, are something which the free market itself, that is to say, voluntary cooperation, is capable of producing. My point being that the acceptance of the view that a society for stability with freedom must have a common set of values does not require accepting the views that those common set of values need to come from someplace other than the free operation of a free society. Thank you.